This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, and it's Friday. However, Senator Sanders is traveling today. In fact, I think he's going out Iowa way, but I could be wrong. And so he's not, literally traveling all day. He's not going to be available during the 3 hours of our program. So there will be no brunch with Bernie today. My apologies. We will get him on next week. So I've got a stack of things. I got half my stack from yesterday. I got a whole brand new stack from today of things that I wanted to share with you. And if you've got anything you want to share with all of us, feel free. It's Anything Goes Friday. So we'll just do that for the 3 hours. Laurie can open up the phone lines right now and party on Garth here. Speaking of which, I've got my licorice sticks arrived. I had, for years, I've done these things for, yes. So it sort of looks like you got a cigarette hanging out of your mouth. This is a real licorice stick. It's, from the plant licorice. Glycyrrhizin glabra is the name of the plant. And as I recall, and the active ingredient in licorice is a chemical called glycyrrhizin, which is a mild stimulant. It's also mildly habit-forming. So licorice candy nowadays has the glycyrrhizin taken out of it because people used to get so hooked on it, basically. It ties up nicotine receptors, so it's good for people who want to quit smoking. But I particularly like it's better than caffeine, in my opinion. So not that I'm recommending that you do it. It does raise blood pressure. It's probably not good for a lot of people. Rudy Giuliani is doubling down on his criticism of President Obama. This racist punk is asserting that the President of the United States does not love his country. To say that of any President of the United States is obscene. But for a racist punk like Rudy Giuliani to say that about, a thoughtful, intelligent man of color like Barack Obama is despicable. I mean, there's just no other word for it. It's despicable. So, anyhow, the ongoing conference on violent extremism is ongoing, and the president is continuing to say, no matter how much Fox News wants me to give ISIS what they want, no matter how much Bill O'Reilly wants me to give the terrorists what they want, no matter how much Sean Hannity wants the United States to give the terrorists what they want, no matter how much right-wing hate radio and all the right-wing websites and the blogosphere and everything else want this administration and this president to give ISIS and Boko Haram and Al-Qaeda what they want, we're not going to do it. We are not going to do it. We are not going to call these murderers. We're not going to call these thugs. We're not going to call these extremists. We're not going to call them Muslims because they are not. Real Muslims don't engage in terror, just like real Christians don't engage in terror, just like real Hindus and real Buddhists don't engage in terror. People who engage in terror and use the name of any religion, their religion or any other religion, to justify that terror are simply running a scam. It's a con. And it's a con that Bill O'Reilly very much wants us to buy into. It's a con that Rudy Giuliani, that racist punk, really wants us to buy into. It is just a con. The president said yesterday, when people are oppressed and human rights are denied, particularly among sectarian lines or ethnic lines, when dissent is silenced, it feeds violent extremism. And so we must recognize that lasting stability and real security require democracy. He said, as we speak, ISIL is terrorizing the people of Syria and Iraq and engaging in unspeakable cruelty. the wanton murder of children, the enslavement and rape of women, threatening religious minorities with genocide, beheading hostages. He said, we and other nations must address the painful truth of how Muslims are all often stigmatized by the West. He said a lot of the bad, like terrorists who claim to speak for Islam, that's absorbed by the general population. Not enough of the good, the more than 1 billion around the world who do not represent or who do represent Islam and are doctors and lawyers and teachers and neighbors and friends. So meanwhile, those who do want, for example, John McCain wants us to give ISIS exactly what they want. He wants the president of the United States to say, yeah, those guys represent Islam. That's what Islam is all about. Scaring the hell out of people, killing people, cutting their heads off, you know, raping women, murdering men, burning people on fire. That's Islam. That's what John McCain wants the president to say. And here's what's so astonishing. The depths of depravity of the Republicans like John McCain, how far down they are willing to go to simply trash this president. The president said, the notion that the West is at war with Islam is an ugly lie. And all of us, regardless of faith, have a responsibility to reject it. That's what the president said yesterday. That we are engaged in a war with Islam. 1.7 billion people around the world. That we are engaged in a war with Islam. The president said, that is a lie. An ugly lie. So John McCain then comes back and says, and I quote, this was in a tweet, he said, the notion that radical Islam isn't at war with the rest is an ugly lie. In other words, he reversed what the president said. And he said that these terrorists represent a strain of Islam, radical Islam, but still Islam. It's amazing. John Kerry called it silly. He says, there's been a silly debate in the media in the last days about what you have to do. You have to do everything. You have to take people off the battlefield who were there today. But you're kind of stupid if all you do is that and you don't pretend more people are going to go to the battlefield. Well, Secretary of State Kerry, respectfully, John McCain is kind of stupid. I mean, he always has been. He's you know, he's just a hustler. The guy's a hustler. But Peter King, the whack job from New York, I'm running out of adjectives for the Republican Party. It's really kind of distressing. He said, we have to stop them and kill them first, and then we can worry about social reasons. But if we're going to stop ISIS by somehow finding what's bothering them, bothering them psychologically, well, actually, it makes a certain amount of sense to figure out why people are engaging in the behavior that they're, you know, why they're doing what they're doing. Because then you can help stop it. When somebody's country is invaded, when hundreds of thousands of their fellow citizens and relatives are murdered, when millions of them are displaced, when they lose access to electricity and water and basic stuff, when their children are dying of entirely preventable diseases, when their medical system has collapsed around them, their educational system's fallen apart, their country is you know, they got the worst birth defect rate in the world because their country is soaked in depleted uranium. When that happens to a country, and you've got, you know, 50, 60, 70% of the young men unemployed, expect problems, you idiot. Come on, John McCain. Yeah, come on, Peter King. What? You guys... Oh, man. Anyway, I have a... there's a whole pile of stuff. Stick around.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Did you know that the more corrupt a country is, the better business does in it? I'll tell you about that after the break. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Craig in Brookfield, Illinois, watching Free Speech TV. Hey, Craig, what's up?
Hi, Tom. How are you? It's an honor to speak to you. Actually, I missed an opportunity in suburban Chicago to get you to sign Crash of 2016. I just was unable to get out there, but try to get the show as much as possible.
Well, thank you.
You know what? I don't want to be redundant, but I also was astounded at Rudy Giuliani's comments. And Peter King, he's just your standard run-of-the-mill xenophobe, but
he's part of the freak show. You know, it's the Republican freak show.
One of the points I wanted to make was our newly elected governor in Illinois, Rauner, came out with a proposed budget just the other day. And, of course, the major things that were hit were was Medicaid, for one. People with special needs, they were going to completely eliminate any ARC association. There's a program around here called Best Buddies where regular students hook up with special needs students. They were going to eliminate that completely. And, pardon me, but it's interesting the first places where they hit. You know, the people with the least amount of voice and whatnot, and that's what they go for.
Yeah.
But, like I said, it's a great show. I try and listen all the time, and keep up the great work.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Craig. I appreciate your call. Robert, in Delhi, Louisiana. Am I saying that right, or is it Delhi?
Yes, sir. That's right. It's Delhi. How are you today?
I'm well, Robert. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's on your mind today?
I'm going to speak about Premier Putin over there in Russia.
Mm-hmm.
That the fact is that the U.S. is putting him in a box. They got an illegal government going, and they pushed him in a box. And how far do you want to push them in with nuclear weapons, you know? I mean, to me, that's our government's crazy for doing that.
Yeah, I agree. There's an interesting story. I'm going to get to this. It's in my stack. There's an interesting story in the BBC this morning about how David Cameron, the Prime Minister of Great Britain, just came out and said words to the effect of, we had no idea back in 2013 when we started pushing into Ukraine, NATO, we had no idea how upset Mr. Putin would be. And really?
How could we not be when Russia was down there back in Mexico? Wouldn't we be upset? I think we would.
Yeah.
Another thing I wanted to mention was the fact that nobody ever talks about the fact that Ronald Reagan, while he was in the White House, his wife Nancy ran the White House with astrology.
Right.
He didn't do anything if it was against her astrology. Well, that's not he obviously was not a Christian, yet everybody says he's so great.
Well, I think there are Christians who believe in astrology, Robert. Ronald Reagan never went to church, neither did Nancy. I don't think that they were, you know, what Jerry Falwell would call a Christian, but you know,
the point is,
that's kind of a thin criticism. There's a lot of stuff you can criticize Reagan for, Robert, but using an astrologer, that's an eccentricity, I think.
Well, I think it goes to his character, his wife's character, and her running him.
Well, she, you know, I'd give her the benefit of the doubt. I think she thought that there was something to astrology, and she wanted things to work out well for her husband's presidency and for the country, and so she was using an astrologer. Yeah, I mean, countries have been using astrologers for thousands of years. I understand, you know, Robert, you're not fond of it, but, you know, trust me, you'll have a lot more effectiveness criticizing Reagan for raising taxes on working people 11 times and for cutting taxes on millionaires and for destroying unions than for going after his astrology. Thanks for the call. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Let me just go through some, you know, very quickly some of the stuff that's in the news that I wanted to share with you, and then we can, you know, talk about whatever you'd like. And you may want to talk about some of this stuff. This was in the Financial Times a couple days ago. The headline is Corruption Doing the Dirt. Here's an astonishing thing. Well, I'll just read you the subhead. It explains the entire thing. The more corrupt a country is, the better the returns its equity markets offer. Equity markets is fancy language for stock market. And this is the annual yearbook of equity returns. It's compiled by the London Business School, and it shows that the more corrupt a country is, the better the returns its equity market offers. In other words, the more corrupt a country is, the more profitable businesses are in that country. Now, why would that be? Well, because a corrupt country doesn't regulate business. A corrupt country doesn't tax business. A corrupt country doesn't stop businesses from operating as monopolies and destroying their competitors. Those all require government intervention. So when you look at the world, the country that the Koch brothers are trying to create here in the United States by buying Scott Walker and buying other politicians all around the country and getting all these guys into office so that they can shrink government, they're trying to create this corrupt country that the Financial Times is talking about. And we're already halfway there, where the politicians are owned by the billionaires, in this case the Koch brothers, where the regulations are done away with so the corporations are more profitable. And the people get sicker and the people die, but hey, who cares about that? You know, they're not the plutocrats. That's just the working people. And so they can be more profitable. It's very simple. It's really astonishing when you think about it. Here's another new study. This smoking's toll on health is even worse than previously thought. Oh, I did this last week, didn't I? There's 12 new kinds of cancer, 10 new diseases that they've added. Anyway, I think I already did that, so I'm going to throw that one away. Here, Koch stooges booed off stage in disastrous attempt to meddle in Montana's Medicaid debate. Dozens of voters shouted down paid staffers from a Koch brothers advocacy group that's targeting a Montana Republican lawmaker who wants to expand Medicaid. So this Republican lawmaker wants to expand Medicaid. The Koch brothers from out of state, through I think it's Americans for Prosperity, one of their front groups, goes after this guy because he had refused to sign the pledge. Are you following this? There's a pledge. The Koch brothers have a pledge. State Representative Frank Garner has refused to sign a blanket pledge against expanding Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act, and Americans for Prosperity Montana is campaigning against him and two other lawmakers, State Representatives Jeff Wellborn and Tom Perry, who have also refused to sign the pledge. The Koch-sponsored group is blanketing their House districts with mailers that show each lawmaker, this is from Raw Story, that show each lawmaker's face superimposed over a photograph of President Barack Obama. So about 100 people showed up at this town hall meeting that was heavily promoted by Americans for Prosperity to trash the state senator. Nobody bothered telling the state senator that Americans for Prosperity is going to trash him in his own district, but he heard about it, and so he showed up. He says, I support their right to have an opinion. I just didn't like how they did it. They didn't even extend the courtesy of telling me about the meetings. What does that say about their intentions? He wants to extend Medicaid coverage to 70,000 low-income Montanans. But the Koch brothers' front group, Americans for Prosperity, is totally opposed to this. And this lawmaker is refusing to sign their pledge that they will not expand Medicaid. One voter said, and I quote, and here's what happened. Americans for Prosperity got up and started trashing this guy. And here's from the story, from Raw Story. Voters frequently interrupted the Americans for Prosperity presentation with laughter, booing, and other jeers from Garner's supporters. Keep in mind, Garner's a Republican. This is Oklahoma. One voter said, you have pissed me off. Character assassination does not go down well in Montana. If he has to take a pledge, then I want it to be the Pledge of Allegiance, because they don't represent you, they represent me. Another voter stood up to the AFP, the Koch brothers, Americans for Prosperity activists, and said, and I quote, why did you call this town hall meeting? I didn't get an invite. I wish I'd been invited, because I want to know how we get the Koch brothers out of politics. I want to know how we get you out of politics. And then the state legislator that they had called the meeting to attack, he stood up and he said, if the purpose is to make sure legislators know, then why am I the only one here? Why didn't I even get an invite? I promised people here when I ran that I would listen to you and not some out-of-town special interest, Garner said to wild applause. If every time they want me to sign a pledge card and I don't do it, and they're going to rent a room and have a meeting, then this is going to get real expensive because I'm not signing the pledge card. Who knew, right, that the Koch brothers even have a pledge card that state legislators have to sign? Why is this not in the news? Why are they not discussing this on Face the Nation or Meet the Press? Oh, that's right. Those networks, the boards of directors of those networks hang out with the same people the Koch brothers hang out with. I'm sorry, I forgot. Okay, remember the DLC, the Democratic Leadership Council, or committee or whatever it was, Bill Clinton's thing? Well, there's a new one. It has replaced the DLC. It's called the New Democrat Network. And back in 2001, Simon Rosenberg, former field director of DLC, who directs the New Democrat Network, said, "We're trying to raise money to help them lessen their reliance on traditional interest groups in the Democratic Party." That would be like the unions, environmentalists. "In that way, they're ideologically freed, frankly, from taking positions that make it difficult for Democrats to win." Oh, really? So the DLC, now the New Dems, think that being in favor of labor, being in favor of the environment, makes it difficult for you to win. Well, in a political environment where the Supreme Court says whoever's got the most money gets to buy the politicians and run the ads, then, yeah, you may be speaking some truth, but that's a sad commentary on the state of our democracy. Vice President of the Institute, Rob Shapiro, Clinton economic advisor, says what we've done in the Democratic Party is an intellectual leveraged buyout. Really? This is amazing. The Democratic Leadership Council, he's got a leveraged buyout of the Democratic Party? Good luck with that, buddy. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
Oh, and the donors to the Koch brothers' new entities that are going to raise, you know, almost $1 billion. Federal judges said you can keep them secret for the moment. Oh, isn't that sweet? Just a couple of other quick news stories. And, you know, I'll continue to drop these in throughout the next 2 hours as we go along. I do want to make space for your calls, though, especially since this goes Friday. And Bernie, if you're just tuning in, Bernie's not with us today. Bernie is traveling out in Iowa, and he is just plain old flat out not available during the it wouldn't be noon to 3 in Iowa. It would be what? No, it'd be like 10 to 1 or something like that. I think they're mountain time. Whatever time they are. Anyhow, he's not available. It's central time, so it's 11 to 2. So he's, but in any case, he's not available. Just a couple of quick other news stories. And GCHQ, which is Britain's CIA or NSA, and our NSA collaborated, apparently, according to a report in The Intercept today, which I think is that Glenn Greenwald's publication, or he writes for them? The Intercept? Okay, anyway. There is a company called Gemalto in Holland that is the world's largest manufacturer of SIM cards. SIM cards are a little tank card that you pop into your phone that gives your phone an identity and a brain. Well, not a brain, I mean all the rest of it, but it's like a super serial number. And it also digitally encodes the data that your phone sends and receives, or it provides the basis for the encryption. And what GCHQ and the NSA did is they broke into or hacked into this company, Gemalto, and so now and stole the codes. So now they can seamlessly wiretap and listen into any cell phone conversation anywhere in the world, because this company makes the SIM cards for pretty much everybody. Its clients in the United States include AT&T, T-Mobile, Verizon, and Sprint. There's no place you can hide. So that's one. Number two, you'll recall the Department of Homeland Security is supposed to run out of money at the end of the month, which I think is like next week. And the Republicans sent a bill to the Senate that would extend the DHS's funding, but they put a poison pill in it that said that none of that money can be used for President Obama to allow Dreamers to stay in the country. The Republicans in the Senate said, that's stupid, we're not going to do that, and they sent back a clean bill to the House. John Boehner is saying, we're going to ignore what the Senate's doing. It's all the Democrats' fault. Apparently nobody's told him that the Republicans run the Senate now. And so what's going to happen? Well, it's probably going to be a continuing resolution. In other words, they'll kick the can down the road a little bit. They'll say, okay, we'll fund it for another 3 months while we fight about it. This is a war within the Republican Party. It's insane. And finally, David Corn has busted Bill O'Reilly, apparently. Now, Bill O'Reilly is denying these allegations, but apparently Bill O'Reilly on maybe more than one occasion has said that he was in a war zone during the Falkland Wars. And it turns out that there were no reporters in the war zone. None of the reporters made it to the Falklands. Bill O'Reilly was in Buenos Aires during a protest there, and he said that the police were using real bullets and they were shooting at us and things. And it turns out that they weren't shooting at anybody. And that one of Bill O'Reilly's, this is when he was with one of the networks, I think CBS, one of the guys with him at CBS said, you know, yeah, we were there. We spent most of our time in the bar because there wasn't that much happening. You know, I mean, there was a protest, but, you know, nobody was getting shot at. So Bill O'Reilly apparently has a Brian Williams problem, shall we say. And Bill O'Reilly's calling David Corn a gutter snipe. Ah, I love it. Anyhow, Mark in Minneapolis. Hey, Mark, what's on your mind today?
Well, hi, Tom. Well, you've thrown a lot of chum in the water.
Yeah.
15 of these subjects, but I want to welcome you again next week to the Blue State Ball.
Thank you. I'm very much looking forward to coming to Minneapolis next Friday.
You bet. The last time we met was at your book signing for Crash of 2016, and I said the most important page of your book was page 86 that talked about Greenspan and Rubin telling Bill Clinton who was actually calling the shots.
Right.
But regarding the domestic surveillance issue, The Intercept, yes, is Glenn Greenwald, and that's Pierre Omidyar, who founded PayPal and eBay.
Ah, but, yeah, okay. The billionaire, yeah.
Yes. But what happened here, Tom, is that this was a direct result of what happened and was completely ignored by the mainstream media, basically, last week, which was the patch of Juul versus the NSA in what is regarded as the most liberal federal district court in the country in San Francisco. And basically what Juul...
That's the Ninth Circuit.
The NSA, yes, yes. Okay. What this ruling was that American citizens in no way, shape, or form associated in any way to terrorism that can prove that they've been on the receiving end of illegal government contract or domestic surveillance have no recourse in the federal court structure, because these companies, like we just found out today, and again, this release was timed because of Juul versus the NSA. Hmm. So basically what this federal court ruled was that American citizens not only have no right to privacy, we have no right to due process, we have no equal access to the courts, we are denied right to counsel, and we are denied to understand the charges against us, even in the event we can provide documentary evidence to the government that we've been targeted.
Wow. So that was the Supreme Court ruling?
No, this was a federal district court ruling of the Ninth District.
Oh, in the Ninth Circuit, yeah, okay.
Last week. Yeah. So all anybody has to do is search Juul versus the NSA. There was a great article in Common Dreams by Nadia Prupi, and they can look this up. But this was completely ignored, and as a result, this release by Ed Snowden and The Intercept came out today. Because one of the questions I wanted to ask Senator Sanders is that, you know, government officials – public officials, political officials, law enforcement, federal law enforcement, and police put their hand on the Bible, take an oath to God to defend the rights of the defenseless and oppressed, and the Constitution against enemies, foreign and domestic. So last week, this federal court ruling undermined the constitutional protections of basically all of our Bill of Rights, and this happened without a sound coming from the mainstream media.
Wow. J-U-L-E versus NSA?
Yes.
Okay. Say that again. Oh, the Electronic Frontier Foundation. I actually read an article about that last week. Yeah, okay. Yeah. Mark, I'm going to dig into this a little more, and we will talk about it more on the radio. Thanks for the heads up on that. I appreciate it. That's pretty astonishing. Alex in Santa Cruz, California. Hey, Alex, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Good morning.
Morning.
I'm a firefighter,
mm-hmm.
and my wife is a public school teacher, and it's always caught my attention. You say that the fire department is a socialist institution, and that interests me, and it also confuses me, because conventionally or traditionally, socialism is defined as owning the government, owning the means of production.
It's or supply.
Kind of a,
yeah.
And when I say that to people, particularly these Republican firefighters, and there's a lot of them, they say, no, 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 the fire department isn't socialist. So can you clarify that you're...
Yeah, it's real simple. In pure capitalism, the government doesn't own anything. Arguably a military, but the military is, a highly socialist organization. The government pays you, the government clothes you, the government feeds you, the government provides you housing, the government provides you medical assistance, and the government provides you education. That's almost communism. That's as pure a socialism as you can get, the military. With a fire department or a police department, these are also socialist institutions in as much as they are owned by the government. If you're a firefighter, Alex, I don't know if you have to pay for your own uniform, but if you don't, the government pays for it. The government pays for your fire truck. The government pays for your equipment. The government pays for your training. The government pays for the firehouse that you work in and that you may sleep in. The government pays for your meals when you're there. That's socialism. Now, it's good socialism. I mean, arguably, there's good socialism and bad socialism, if you want to use these definitions. Good socialism is figuring out where the appropriate... So this is why we have a mixed economy and a mixed country. We are not capitalist. We are not all free enterprise. We are not all socialist. We're not, it's not that simple. It doesn't reduce to a bumper sticker. But, there are appropriate areas where government should be doing these things, because if you turn them over to the private sector, there's all what are called perverse incentives. We tried private firefighting forces, and it was a wreck. It didn't serve the public good. Made some people some money, but it didn't serve the public good. So am I making sense? The same with our schools. You and your wife don't have to be socialists to take a job at these socialist institutions. But, these are government-owned, and so by definition, they are more socialist than they are capitalist, certainly. Making sense, Alex?
It makes sense to me, yeah. But I point out also I disagree because with your statement about the government paying for our food, because when you see firefighters at the supermarket, they're paying out of their own.
Are they really? That should not be. If you're buying food for consumption on the job in the firehouse, because you've got to stay. My understanding is you guys work. You don't work an 8-hour day. You work longer shifts, right? A day on, day off kind of thing.
I work 48 hours on.
Right. So during that 48 hours, your employer should be paying for your food, and your employer is the government. So, it's very unfortunate if you're having to buy your own food. Alex, you got to move along, but thanks for the call. This whole conversation of where does the commons begin and end, and where should the private space begin and end, is one that we don't have enough in the United States we really need. Great job, Alex. Thank you.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
My licorice stick is starting to splinter and disintegrate. Yummy. We'll be back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Kathy, watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Network in Etna, Wyoming. Hey, Kathy, what's up?
Hey, Tom, I've got a question.
Mm-hmm.
President Obama says that he will veto the Keystone XL bill if it comes to his desk, which I think is great, and I fully support it. But what I don't understand is, why would he stop this bill when he allowed, several years ago, he allowed the southern half to be built?
Right. Well, actually, the construction of the southern half started under the George W. Bush administration, but Obama didn't stop it. You're right.
I thought it was President Obama that approved the southern half. So if I'm wrong, I stand corrected.
Yeah, back to when Bush was president, we were interviewing on the air. In fact, Daryl Hannah was down at one of the sites. We were interviewing on the air people who in Texas who were standing in the way of the pipeline because their land was being taken by eminent domain. This has been going on for a decade and a half at least. But that said, the reason why the president is threatening to veto the legislation is because he's asserting that building the pipeline or not building the pipeline is not the business of the legislature. It's the business of the executive branch, because the thing that is at issue here is not whether the pipeline should be built, for example, from North Dakota or Montana or whatever down to Texas. The question is whether the pipeline should be allowed to cross the Canadian-U.S. border. Excuse me.
Right.
One of the downsides of eating licorice is you get little pieces of licorice in your throat. excuse me. And that is not Congress's call. That's the executive branch's call. This has to do with the relationship with a foreign country and a foreign company, TransCanada. And that's a decision that has to be made by the executive branch. And that's why he's saying he would veto the legislation, not because he's in favor of or opposed to the Keystone XL pipeline. I think, frankly, he's probably, I mean, the pressure on him is insane. And, you know, much of the pipeline has already been built. And I'm guessing that it's probably going to happen. I think it's, we're going to have some disastrous fallout from it, and, you know, we'll learn our lesson. But my understanding is, Kathy, that that's why he's saying he's going to veto it, because it's not Congress's job to pass it. Make sense?
Thank you.
Okay, you're welcome. Thank you very much for the call. Jim in Vida, Montana. Hey, Jim, what's up? You want to talk about Keystone too?
Right. I'm out here in Glenbeckistan, and I get the North Dakota Evening News.
Uh-huh.
And last night on the Minot Evening News, they reported that TransCanada has filed an application with the state and with the U.S. State Department to run a pipeline from western North Dakota north into Canada to
right.
connect up with an existing tar sands pipeline.
Right,
so,
and then they're taking it east across Canada, all the way out to
right.
New Brunswick. Yeah.
Yeah, probably. So I think this takes away some of the argument for Keystone, at least out here, because they always claim 20 or 30% of the volume in Keystone would be from North Dakota and Montana.
Right.
So it could be a significant development.
Yeah, it could be.
The other thing is.
Go ahead.
The other thing is, we had this big oil spill in the Yellowstone River here by Glendive, Montana. You know,
right.
a couple of weeks ago, and they always say, "Well, if there's a spill, we'll just clean it up." But guess what? These rivers freeze over in the wintertime. They
oh,
have
yeah.
not cleaned it up.
Oh, yeah, you're right.
Over.
Yeah. Thank you for the call, Jim. You're absolutely right. The rivers do freeze up. Let me tell you, we'll be back. Minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Tom Harbin here with you. Boy, is it cold. We had a grackle down below. We're the building that we're in, they're going to tear down in a year or so, and we're going to have to move sometime in the summer. And they're tearing down the building next to it right now. And this morning I was hearing all this crash, bang, blah, and some guy yelling, and then this grackle. We're on the sixth floor, and this grackle shows up on my windowsill. And he's begging to get into the studio. And he's talking to me. Every time I look at him, every time I turn around and look, he's there in the window. And it's like 10 degrees out or something. I mean, it's insanely cold here. It got down to 3 or 4 degrees last night in Washington, D.C. And I'm convinced that what happened was when they were tearing down the building down next door, they tore down the Grackle's home. And he was desperately searching for a birdhouse or a place to get out of the cold. And, you know, I couldn't open the window. The windows are painted shut. Even if I wanted to, I couldn't. But and had he gotten in here, I think he would have been just as unhappy, because this is not a good place for a grackle to live. Meanwhile, last night, I was up half the night because we're being lifted up out of the ice as the ice. Yeah, we've got 3 inches of ice now all around the boat. And it got down to 2 degrees. We could not hold the temperature in our little bedroom, which, you know, we've got two electric heaters running, and we could not hold the temperature above 55 last night, or above, maybe it was even in the high 40s, low 50s. And so Louise and I were like under the, you know, feather comforter, curl around each other, try for body heat, and both cats. Or two of our three cats came and who typically don't like each other, don't hang out with each other, right on top of us and right on top of each other. I mean, it was like it was a two cat night. And but it's interesting because everybody in the marina, we were all talking about this over the last week or so. I mean, when it gets down to zero Fahrenheit, we've never seen that before. I mean, nobody alive today has ever seen zero Fahrenheit in Washington, D.C., and nobody who's ever lived in this marina has ever seen zero Fahrenheit. And even though my boat's 30 years old, it's never seen zero Fahrenheit. And so we were really concerned, you know, will the docks hold up? Will the will the hulls, you know, get damaged? Will the water pipes freeze? Will the, you know, what? How bad is it going to get? Are we going to exceed the power capacity of the dock? And that was my big concern. Was all night I kept listening to make sure that A, the water was running so that, you know, it didn't freeze up, and B, that the electric fans were on, because the power does go down there typically a couple of times a day for a few minutes at a time, because there's these ground fault interrupters, and whenever anybody plugs something new into their boat, it blows the whole dock, and then everybody's got to run out to the thing and reset the breakers. But when it goes down, it's like that boat gets so cold so fast. And we have we bought these 2x2 foot squares of 3/8 inch bubble wrap, and we've got it on all the windows, taped on. It's like we've insulated the boat, but it's 0 degrees. This is nuts. But you know, we're making it through. But the thing is that it astonishes me is that nobody is talking about. And mark my words, 3-4 years from now, you are going to be hearing this in the press constantly, because it's going to become conventional wisdom. Right now, it's cutting edge science. And so you read about it in the science journals, but nobody's talking about it in the mainstream media. And it's also nobody's talking about the mainstream media because the Koch brothers are making Republican lawmakers sign pledges and things, or at least the Koch brothers front groups. This is caused by global warming. I think it's so ironic. I was thinking about this as I was walking up to the street today, freezing my butt off. It is so cold that, wow, our building just shook. That's amazing. This is the demolition that they're doing next door. It just struck me that the cold is the consequence of our burning fossil fuels to stay warm. Now think of the irony of that for a moment. We have been burning fossil fuels since Colonel Drake discovered, you know, the first commercial oil well in the United States in 1865 in Titusville, Pennsylvania. From that time until now, we've burned 300 and some odd, nearly 400 billion tons of fossil fuel and put that much carbon into the atmosphere, which is a mind-boggling amount. And we did a lot of it to stay warm. And what that is doing is breaking down the jet stream, this river of air that circles the Arctic Ocean. That jet stream that used to keep the cold air up in the far north, that's breaking down because it's warming up. And it doesn't have the cold rigidity that it used to have. And it's allowing this cold air to just spill all the way down to Florida. This is going to be, mark my words, this is going to be the new normal. You think this cold was, you know, weird, an exception. You're going to start seeing it every year, every other year, every third year. We're going to have these kinds of winters. And we need to be adapting to them and getting ready for them, because this is what climate change looks like. And the irony that for 150 years, the human race has been keeping itself warm by burning fossil fuels. And as a consequence of that, at least in the northern hemisphere, we're now being frozen. Because the other terrible side effect of this is that when Arctic air comes all the way this far south, where there's a hell of a lot of heat still trapped in the ground, that heat radiates out of the ground into the air, that air goes back up to the Arctic, warmer now, and it speeds up the rate at which the Arctic is melting, which speeds up the rate at which the jet stream breaks down, which speeds up the rate at which this kind of weather becomes normal. Which is not a good thing. It's really amazing. It's really amazing how we have terraformed our planet. And I mean, you know, we all know we've done that with agriculture and things, but now we've done it with our climate. And what are we going to do next? Anyhow, my apologies for the rant. I should never apologize for ranting. But we've got a full board of calls. All 12 lines are occupied. We will be picking your calls up right after the break. Stick around.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com. Total protection. Quicken Loans. Engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Boy, just looking at the headlines on Think Progress, black primary school students in Rhode Island are six times more likely to be suspended than white peers. Police arrest two men under anti-sodomy law declared unconstitutional in 2003. Oklahoma bill would make couples prove they don't have sexually transmitted diseases before getting married. Congressman claims immigrants are netting $24,000 each from Obama's executive action. This is Paul Gosar, Republican from Arizona, just making crap up. It's amazing. Hours after anti-Obama lawyers file brief, an ally reveals that the brief's key claim is false. What a surprise. What a surprise. Anything. Anyhow, anything goes Friday. Kamaru in Dayton, Ohio. Hey, Kamaru. What's up?
Hey, Tom. Good afternoon to you.
Thank you. Back at you. What's up?
My real serious problem is the progressive denial of the science of 9/11. And I would like... especially you, I keep hearing you deny it, and it just amazes me that you keep doing that.
Uh-huh.
Let me
tell you what I'm denying, Kamaru. I don't find it credible, probable, and frankly even possible that Mr. Silverman, the guy who owned those three buildings, hired some group, or the government did, or somebody did, wired explosives in three of New York City's largest buildings in a way that nobody noticed and left no, you know, significant consequential trace. And then after having wired all those explosives, managed to set them off at exactly the same moment or shortly thereafter, after two planes hit the World Trade, you know, I don't believe that Mr. Silverman or our government coordinated the attack on 9/11 with Mohammed Atta and all those other guys. I do believe that George W. Bush knew something really horrible was going to happen. I do believe that. And that he was therefore afraid to come back to Washington, D.C. It's why he took the longest vacation in presidential history, stayed down in Texas for I think it was over a month. And then even then, when he was supposed to go back to D.C., he was afraid to because he knew something horrible was going to happen. He just didn't know what, in my opinion. I'm just telling you my opinion. And so he went to Florida to hang out in a state that his brother ran because his state could offer, because his brother, you know, put the state in lockdown, in emergency mode. How are you going to convince me?
May I introduce two scientific principles?
Sure.
May I? Okay. Okay. First of all, the buildings, all three of them, fell at free fall speed. That is not possible from a plane running into the building.
Sure it is. It happened twice.
It's happened three times. No, twice. It happened twice and in the history of the world.
Right.
It's only happened twice.
Well, it's only twice that a building that tall that is constructed with those kind of central steel reinforcing beams, as opposed to external steel reinforcing beams, has been hit with a plane carrying, you know, 4,000 miles worth of jet fuel.
Jet fuel is just kerosene. That's all it is. And
right.
It can't melt steel.
Sure it can.
You can't do that.
Sure it can. All you have to do is add enough oxygen to it fast enough.
Let me go to the second point.
Well, wait a minute, Kamara. Your first point is wrong. There are all kinds of devices that you can run kerosene through or any other number of fuels that might ignite at 700 or 800 or 900 degrees, might normally burn at those temperatures. But if you put them into an oxygen-rich environment, if you put them into basically a wind, they will burn at 1,000, 1,500, 2,000, 2,500 degrees. The temperature goes up radically as the rate of combustion goes up.
Steel and concrete fall at free fall speed?
Yes.
Come on, Tom. Come on.
No, have you ever used a welding torch tomorrow?
Yes, I have.
Okay. You know that when you first turn the thing on and light it, when it's a very small flame, it's not all that hot. You can put you don't want to put it right on your hand, but you can put your hand near it. It's just a flame, right? You turn it up to the point that a lot of air is getting mixed with that gas before it hits the point of ignition, which is what happens with the tip of a welding torch. They're designed to suck air around the outside. It's superheated air because it's coming through the flame first. It's sucked into the thing, and then it comes out through these little tiny nozzles and mixes with the gas. And now you can crank that gas that ignites and typically burns at 725 or whatever it is degrees, the typical temperature for hydrocarbons to burn. That will burn at 2,000 degrees, and it will melt steel.
And then it's going to fall at free fall speed.
Right.
No.
Yeah, when it's lost. You had 20 stories above it that weighed, millions of tons, and the support is gone. They fall onto it, and everything just gives way.
But when it hits the buildings below, then they're going to provide resistance. And that resistance will stop the free fall speed.
It doesn't, Kamara. Watch, you know, go on YouTube and just look at the videos of buildings being demolished. They demolish buildings all the time. They don't take out every support. They just take out the critical supports, and the weight of the building takes out everything else.
Okay, and then the second point, if I may.
Please.
Nanothermite was found in the dust. By reputable scientists. So, now, where did the nanothermite come from, Tom? Did it come from these planes? They were carrying nanothermite? No. No. Where did it come from?
Well,
The last thing that I would ask you, and I would really appreciate if you would do this, the architects and engineers for 9/11 Truth.
I've had them on the show.
On
I've this. Read their stuff. I'm
you
familiar
have?
With their website. I've watched the videos.
Oh, I missed it. I try to get.
Yeah, it was 2 years ago, 2-3 years ago, Kamara. I'm just not persuaded. And the size of a conspiracy that it would take, you know, I'm not saying that it's impossible. I'm just saying it's so improbable that I don't consider it. You know, I don't take it seriously.
I say you're science deniers.
Say that again. Am I a science? Are you? You're asserting that I'm a science denier? No,
you are a science denier because scientifically, it is not possible for an asymmetrical injury to a building for that building to fall symmetrically.
When that asymmetrical injury takes out the center support posts so that the top floors fall down onto those two or three floors that are on fire and then keeps falling straight down, yeah, it's perfectly possible. It happened.
No, it happened twice.
We all watched it.
It didn't happen.
So you're telling me don't trust my lying eyes?
I'm telling you, trust your lying eyes because the plane went into the building.
I saw a plane hit a building, and I saw the building collapse. It makes sense that there's a relationship between the two.
One side only, and the building...
No, the supports for that building run up the center, and both planes hit the center. They went through the center, in fact, and ended up over on the other side of the building to some extent. I don't think either one of us are going to convince the other, but I think, Kamaro, hopefully we have both spoken our truths here. 15 minutes past the hour. Thanks for the call. We'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Next up, Anything Goes Friday. How about contrails or pigeons or aliens? Welcome back. 15 minutes past the hour. Yeah, but Shane was just saying oxyacetylene torches are called oxyacetylene because they add oxygen. I wasn't even talking about that. I was just talking about those things you can get out of the hardware store, and you buy a tank of butane or propane or whatever it is, and you screw a nozzle on the end of it, and you light that nozzle. And it's just a flame. It's like lighting a match. And you turn up the gas fast enough that it's starting to suck air through, and it's the design of the nozzle. It's how that company got rich. You know, it's whoever invented that thing and patented it. So anyway, pick up some phone calls here. Morris in Long Beach, California, listening on KPFK. Hey, Morris, what's up?
Professor, a former government employee by the name of Barbara Hanegger, H-O-N-E-G-G-E-R.
I know Barbara.
She says that the House of Representatives, not the Florida officials, had the responsibility to settle the controversy in the 2000 presidential election. Is that true?
According to the Constitution, yes.
My goodness. And well, also, Ms. Hanegger is also making a very strong case for a conspiracy at the highest levels of government regarding the 9/11. Now, her focus wasn't so much the Twin Towers of the other third building, but the Pentagon. And the one thing that the Pentagon and all the other buildings have in common were internal explosives. Now, you might have been able to get a radical group into the Twin Towers to set those, but the most secure building known to mankind ever is the Pentagon.
Yeah.
So there's no way you're going to get explosives into the Pentagon unless you've got some cooperation. Now, she's got a presentation. It's a three-hour presentation, and she names the people who are responsible for those events. And you said you know her. I'll send you $100 to your program if you'll get her on.
Well, Barbara has been on our program many times, and she's never – I don't think, to the best of my knowledge, she's never been on here talking about 9/11. And I have not read her 9/11 stuff, so I can't speak to her 9/11 theories.
Well, it wasn't so much the 9/11 of the Twin Towers as it was the Pentagon.
Right.
And it was a footnote. Now, what she's suggesting, you know, Jesus, Professor, this is crazy. What she's suggesting, the highest levels of people in government knew what was going on, and including Mr. Bush. And Mr. Bush is sitting there in a classroom while people are jumping out of windows there at the Twin Towers, right?
Right.
And if you listen to her timeline, when this event took place, when that event took place, Professor, Jesus, there's more than meets the eye here. There may well be,
Morris. I went halfway into the conspiracy theory, you'll recall, in the last segment by saying that, in my opinion, George W. Bush knew something was going to happen. And it scared the bejesus out of him. I mean, he was, and in fact, after 9/11, his plane, you remember, he flew from city to city to city. He was like hop, skip, and jumping for a couple of hours because he was so afraid that they would figure out where he was and blow him up or kill him or something. I mean, he was genuine. He was running like a rabbit.
According to her, the owners of the Twin Towers, the Rockefellers, they sent a letter. It's all online. The 1 year before, they sent a letter out saying they were going to have another Pearl Harbor catastrophe, and they had one. And, I mean, well orchestrated. And the focus here is because of that event, because of what took place on 9/11, is how we got to what we call our police state, our security state.
I agree with that, Morris. I agree with that, and I think that, in fact, you might even be able to convince me that people in the Bush administration allowed 9/11 to happen, thinking that it would provide them with the rationale for an invasion of Iraq, that it would resurrect or it would save Bush's presidency, which was going down in the tubes in September of 2001. But 20 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Matt in East Jordan, Michigan. Hey, Matt, what's on your mind?
Yeah, good afternoon, Tom.
Hey, Matt.
27 below zero here last night.
Really? Wow.
Yeah, really.
That's insane.
I live right near Charlevoix.
Oh, yeah.
Yes, where your parents, yeah. Right.
That's where my parents are buried, and my mom was born and grew up. Yep.
Yeah, very, very cold for here. What you briefly mentioned the breakdown of the Gulf Stream. I mean, that was the theme of that movie a few years ago, The Day After Tomorrow, that got quite a bit of criticism, actually. But
yeah,
that movie was on. I saw it a couple of days while I was on a treadmill at the gym. Actually, anyone want to call about, I wanted to briefly mention it was exactly 10 years ago today that the left lost a real giant when Hunter Thompson tragically decided to end his life.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure that many of your listeners out there, and certainly you, you've read what he wrote the day of 9/11, which 9/11 seems to be a topic that we can't get over. But he prophetically wrote in that ESPN article, he was working for ESPN at the time there, about how we would be at an endless war. It would be a religious jihad, which the Republicans are very much trying to do. I'm not, as a leftist, I'm not a real big fan of this president, actually, but the president is bending over backwards to try to prevent this from becoming a religious jihad. And the conservatives are doing all they can to make this a religious jihad. And that's exactly what Hunter Thompson, the very day of 9/11, predicted.
Mm-hmm.
He predicted, you know, a state of fear, which was kind of an ongoing theme of many of the things that he wrote about during his whole life.
Right.
An enemy that we wouldn't really know, and he would just go on for the rest of his life. And for anyone that hasn't read it, you know, I think it would be a good opportunity to just take the time to reread it. It's only a few paragraphs, and there's more insight in that few paragraphs, I think, than just the mountains of things that we've heard or seen since.
Well, thanks for the heads up, Matt. I will go off in search of that. I was unaware of it. And thank you for reminding us that today is the anniversary of Hunter S. Thompson's departure from this earth, shall we say, or at least the Hunter S. Thompson part of Hunter S. Thompson that was Hunter S. Thompson, if that makes any sense. Wayne in Chicago. Hey, Wayne, what's up?
Hey, how you doing, Tom?
Good. How are you?
Okay. I just wanted to make a few comments about credibility.
Mm-hmm.
Papers like the New York Times, the Washington Post, Wall Street Journal, when you talk about subjects like the Ukraine, they're just complete liars. So we can't trust what these newspapers write. We have to depend on our own selves, do our own reading and research. And also, we want to listen to people like you, progressive talk radio, because we know the conservative talk radio, lying is their forte, so it's a waste of time even listening to them. But what I want to talk about is this vaccine deal. Okay, all the progressive radio shows had it wrong, and for about a month, all of you kept spouting the mainstream media and the vaccine mafia, you know, their spin on it. You guys were drinking the Kool-Aid. What bothers me is I haven't heard not one of you say I was wrong about that, and here's the new information.
Okay, Wayne, what do you think I was wrong about?
Well, you were citing the mainstream media and the vaccine mafia studies, saying that there's never been a case of autism found.
I never said that.
Excuse me?
I never said that.
No, you did.
No, I didn't. Wayne, I didn't. I'm telling you. I personally believe that there may be an association between vaccines and thimerosal and autism. I don't know that for a fact, and I don't typically, in fact, this is probably the first time I've ever said that out loud on the radio, because I don't want to encourage people not to vaccinate their kids. But I do want our government to force the vaccine companies to take thimerosal, mercury, out of the vaccines. I think that that's the toxic thing. But I also think that you know, going from kids, when I was a kid, you know, I got maybe four shots in my life. I mean, it was polio and smallpox. And, I mean, I was a kid in the 50s. I mean, this was even before there was a measles or a mumps or a rubella shot. And now kids are getting like 40, 50 shots by the time they're 5 or 6 years old. And it concerns me that that's a massive overload to their immune system. And I think that we should be more thoughtful and more careful about which vaccines we're giving kids and you know, where the cost-benefit trade-off is. Hep B, for example. Okay. We're giving kids Hep B vaccine as little children. And, you know, Hep B, you know, it can be a terribly serious disease for some people and not so much for other people. And it's like Hep B is sexually transmitted. Why vaccinate a 3-month-old for it? You know, it's something that people don't have to worry about until they're sexually active, unless they're going to get a blood transfusion. And
okay, let me give you an example. Okay, that doctor that the CDC said his tests were all wrong. Well, they are the ones who made his tests all wrong.
I know. We had Bobby Kennedy on about this last week, Wayne. We had Bobby Kennedy on here for a whole hour debunking the CDC's 3 studies on the safety of thimerosal in vaccines.
Right. But what I'm saying is you, like you, Stephanie Miller, you guys were going with that, what they said at first. That's what I'm saying. You guys were going.
Well, I can't speak for Stephanie. I'll tell you where I stand on this, Wayne, and I have always stood on this, is that I know from personal experience, I've been in countries where people are not vaccinated, where there is a, you know, particularly polio. When you've seen a bunch of people with polio, you remember it. And I've seen that in Sudan. I've seen that in Uganda. At least I believe it was polio. Who knows? But the organizations that I was working with, we're doing polio vaccine programs, and they're saving kids' lives. Vaccines generally can save kids' lives. It's just the question that we have to ask ourselves is, have we gone nuts with these things? And are we allowing manufacturers, in order to save money, to manufacture them in ways that are not healthy for us, i.e. putting mercury in? That's the beginning and end of my position, Wayne, and I stand by it. So thank you for the call. I don't think that I'm misleading it. This is where I believe.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
It's a good thing to get vaccines if you're going to be exposed to diseases or there's a possibility, and a good thing to vaccinate your kids. Just ask for the vaccine that doesn't have the mercury. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. 28 minutes before the hour. Shane and I were just talking about this. The rumor is that based on hiring, Apple has been hiring people away from Tesla, apparently. And it looks like they're building a factory, or might be building a factory, to make electric cars. And that would be cool. So I was speculating. I was wondering, you know, Apple's sitting on $100 billion that they're keeping offshore so they don't have to pay U.S. taxes on it. Why don't they just use that money to acquire Tesla? Rather than competing with them, why not just buy them? And although I don't know if that's possible, and Tesla is domiciled in the U.S. and all that cash is overseas, but Apple's domiciled actually in Ireland. So I mean, it's not that hard to change your domicile, your country of basis. Yeah, that's right. Apple is not an American company anymore. It's an Irish company for tax purposes. But anyway. Who knows what's going to happen? Linda in Deerfield Beach, Florida. Hey, Linda, you want to talk about Canada and eminent domain? Linda?
Yes. I'm here. Can you hear me?
I hear you just fine.
Okay. Number one, your book is brilliant. I think every student should start reading it. It's Crash of 2016. It's very, very, very one of your best.
Thank you.
My second question is, and thank you for taking the time. Last week in our Sun Sentinel, which is our daily paper here, there's a small little blurb about Trans Canada, how they are claiming that eminent domain, and they've got 13 cases in the lower court for North Dakota, I believe it is, that that's their land and they want it. And so far this judge has like been throwing them out, but they're trying it all these different angles to say that's their land.
Right.
They're a Canadian company. How
right.
can they claim that?
Well, the
and
what was the Supreme Court case that Kilo v. Synod of New London, Connecticut. Thank you, Shana. This is what I think drove David Souter off the bench. was the Supreme Court ruled in the Kelo case back about, I don't know, a decade, a little less than a decade ago, that if, you know, it used to be that eminent domain, which is in the Fifth Amendment, it basically says the government can take your property, but they have to, for legitimate government purposes. In other words, if they want to build a road, they want to build a school, they want to build a hospital, the government can take your property without your consent. They just have to reimburse you an amount equal to the fair value of your property. So in the Kelo decision, up until that point, it had been only the U.S. government that could take your property. But in the Kelo case, what was issue here was in the New Haven, Connecticut, or New London, Connecticut, wanted to acquire land from a bunch of landholders. It was a very nice beachfront or near to, it had a view of the ocean, right? It was fancy property, but it was in a really rundown area. It was a very poor area. And so they wanted to declare this city land, and then they wanted to lease that land to, or maybe sell it, I don't remember which, to developers who were going to put up fancy stores and malls and all kinds of stuff. And the rationale was, even though this was going to a private corporation, it wasn't going for a government function, that these private corporations would be paying more in taxes, and therefore it would benefit the public good. And that has stood, and that's why people started, you know, in New Hampshire, they tried to take David Souter's home by eminent domain. I mean, there was this whole big effort around it. And that's the rationale that TransCanada would be using, or at least, you know, the municipalities or counties or state of North Dakota, whatever it is, whoever is declaring the eminent domain would be saying, yeah, bringing TransCanada in, giving this land to them will inure a net positive benefit to our state, our region, our country, whatever. So making sense, Linda?
Yeah, but, well, it makes a little bit of sense, but aren't they a corporation that is out of the country?
That's correct.
They're Canadian, right?
Yeah, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. If, you know, about 1/7, I believe, of all the business property in this country is owned by foreigners. It's we have been giving away our country for the last 40 years as a result of our massive trade deficits and our stupid trade policies. There's a lot of foreign-owned land in this country and a lot of foreign-owned businesses. And then you've got businesses like Apple that just redomicile themselves or parts of themselves in Ireland and other countries for tax purposes. So I disagree with the Kelo decision. I think it was a wrong decision. A lot of people disagree with it. People on the right in particular disagree with it, interestingly, although they're all in favor of that logic being used to take land on behalf of Keystone XL. I think as a principle it was a bad decision. But I understand this is the law of the land now, given the Supreme Court coup d'etat, you know, that they've just named themselves kings and queens of America. And so that's how it's proceeding. Linda, I got to move along, but thank you for the call. Bill in St. Helens, Oregon. Hey, Bill, you want to talk about Rudy Giuliani? I've got something to share with you.
And if you've covered this, I apologize because I missed it. But you know, Tom, everybody understands the comments Giuliani made about the president. My concerns, I'm really concerned that they're attempting to set a very dangerous precedent, and I really think this was kind of a litmus test to see if they get away with it. And what I'm talking about is, you know, when they take on his words, the president of the United States' words or actions, I guess we can argue they're fair game. But when they start purporting to define his personal motives, thoughts, beliefs, intentions, opinions, etc., when they start doing that, what's to stop them from defining the president's most personal thoughts on foreign relations, diplomatic negotiations, just president?
Oh, they already have. I mean, it wasn't Giuliani, but, you know, people of his stripe and ilk have over the years asserted that Obama wants to do things that are better for Muslims than for us, that are better for, you know, whatever. I mean, you know, they've accused him of all kinds of things.
Yeah, but they've actually gone so far as to try and tell the world how this man actually thinks and feels about it. I know they have done it, but I'm saying where's the line drawn? What if they say, you know, he really hates Iran. You know what? He's got a thing for bucks and blondes.
They can say anything. He's a public figure, Bill. There are no lines. They can literally say anything. The one thing that keeps them from going over the top is public approval or public disapproval. And there is such now a hard right infrastructure, a hard right bubble that guys like Giuliani can live entirely inside of. Never go on any network other than Fox News. Never go on any radio program other than Hannity or the other hate radio guys. Never write anything for any publication other than places like the Daily Caller or the Drudge Report. That they can live in that world and pretty much ignore people who are horrified by what they say. By the way, I said I've got something for you, Bill. You know, Rudy Giuliani said yesterday that the president doesn't love America, and that the reason why he doesn't love America is the values that he was raised with, the way that he was brought up. Okay? So President Obama was raised by his grandfather, by and large. I mean, his mother also, Stanley Dunham, but his grandfather and his grandmother were, you know, major actors in his life. And in fact, his soul, I mean, his mom stayed in Indonesia for, I believe it was a year, while Obama came back here and just lived with his grandparents. His grandfather served in World War II, and literally, I mean, not just served in World War II, but was there for the, he was part of the invasion of Normandy. You know, I mean, it doesn't get better than that, right? Being one of the guys who invaded France at Normandy to throw back Hitler. That was Obama's grandfather. Those were the values that he got from his grandfather and from his mother, his mother's father. On the other hand, there's Rudy Giuliani's dad, because Rudy Giuliani is talking about the values he grew up with. Who was Rudy Giuliani's dad? Well, Rudy Giuliani's dad was a guy named Harold Giuliani. And Harold Giuliani did not serve in the military during World War II, even though he was of the appropriate age. The reason why he didn't serve in World War II was because he was a convicted felon. Rudy Giuliani's father, Harold, served a 1.5-year term in Sing Sing prison after robbing a milkman at gunpoint. Which website is this from so I can credit them? Crooks and Liars. This is from Crooks and Liars. And note to Crooks and Liars, you should put your the name on your articles. Anyhow, reading from this article by Steve M. Excuse me. Harold Giuliani served a 1.5-year jail term in Sing Sing prison after robbing a milkman at gunpoint in 1934. This was about a decade before Rudy was born. Rudy also alleges that not Rudy Giuliani, but this is the book, Rudy, an investigative biography of Rudy Giuliani by Wayne Barrett. So Wayne Barrett writes, Harold Giuliani served as the muscle for a loan sharking outfit, claiming that he broke legs. These are quotes from Harold Giuliani. Broke legs, smashed kneecaps, and crunched noses in the 1950s, even taking part in a gunfight in a Brooklyn street in the 1960s. And during the time of war, at the time of Rudy's birth, Harold was working in the Brooklyn Navy Yard as a plumber's assistant, the trade he learned before he went to prison. World War II lasted more than 4.5 years. D-Day was just 9 days away, and Harold wasn't drafted because he had a criminal record. You could not serve in the military if you had a criminal record without an exception. So, gee, what about that, Bill?
Yeah, well, I think we've now moved into a world of politically acceptable sedition. Sedition is sedition, and whether it's Giuliani or the Congress of the United States, when they directly undermine the president's ability to do his job in his official capacity, that is by definition a seditious act, and that's what we need to start talking about.
Yeah,
Tom.
I agree. And I think that there's a fair amount of very, very bad and very scary sedition going on in the United States. I do not disagree with you, Bill, on that. I doubt it's prosecutable, but it should be prosecutable morally in the court of public opinion. We should be calling these. Thank you for the call, Bill. We should be calling these people out. ABC, CBS, NBC, CNN, MSNBC. They all at Fox News. God, I'm just astonished that Fox News allows this kind of stuff on their airwaves. But, you know, I don't know. Maybe Roger Ailes and Rupert Murdoch hate America.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
I mean, Roger Ailes is this paranoid, frightened little man, and Rupert Murdoch used to be an Australian billionaire. Maybe they're the ones who hate America. Who knows? 15 minutes before the hour. When I said Roger Ailes was little, I was not referring to his physical stature. I don't personally know how big he is. But these little men, these insecure, frightened little men like George W. Bush and Dick Cheney and Roger Ailes and whatnot that want to bring the world to the brink. I mean, it's just tragic. Jesse, watching Free Speech TV in Miami. Hey, Jesse, how are you? What's up?
Yeah, Miami's cold too.
Is it really?
Yeah, and I heard Niagara Falls is frozen over too. They need to be putting that on pictures on TV.
There you go. Yeah. That's amazing.
Hey,
so what's
I
up?
Need your help. I was explaining to my niece the other day about the taxation without representation.
Right.
And I was trying to explain to her what the new world would probably look like for her and the young generation. Greece is the number one story I see today. What they do, pretty much the rest of the world is going to have to follow. So connecting the dots, work without representation. That's the dot I want to connect to taxation without representation.
Well, work without representation is not being allowed to have a union in your workplace.
Well, I want to go further than that. The basic idea of the boss, the capitalists, they the reason why we give them everything. They the reason we sacrifice our firstborn, whatever, because they have an idea, they invented the wheel or whatever. Mm. They control our total work sphere, whereas the kings and queens control the political sphere, whatever. But how do we put a dent in this world of theirs, the way they think they control things because they have an idea? I think Elizabeth Warren hit it pretty much on the head when she beat back the guys when the job creators said, well, we created things. Everybody kind of got quiet. And then she come back just as strong and said, well, we help you.
Right.
And nobody could deny that. And then you look at the feminist thing, it's like you go through a divorce and you say, well, I done made everything. I brought home the bacon. And then the little lady says, but I help you. Holly, nobody listens to her because she's not in a strong position to challenge. She can't beat them up or whatever.
Right.
But you look at the rules in the courts now. There was a story not too long ago about a lady got $1 billion in alimony, and then she said, that's not enough. Everybody said, what?
Right.
I want half of what my man got. He was worth like $20 billion. So I'm thinking, would that be a good explanation to try to define work without representation by saying, okay, a lady goes to court now, she get half.
Hmm.
Now they got these prenuptial agreements where the guy said, well, I made it before I knew you and all of that. So
yeah, I think you're wandering into an area that's probably way too complex for a kid. If you want to talk about work without representation, there's two separate issues here. Work without representation is working in a workplace where you literally do not know the owner of the company. They're remote. They're someplace else. So you can't represent yourself to the owner. And there's no union. The issue of women being appropriately compensated for the work they do is a huge issue, Jesse, and I agree with you on that. I think, for example, that Social Security should consider child rearing as an occupation and should assume that people have, even though they don't pay into Social Security, that they have an income equivalent to that for those years that they've been child rearing. Jesse, thank you for the call. Welcome back. 10 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. And let's check in with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. And find out what's going on in the world. Victoria Jones on the line with us. Victoria? I can't pick up the phone. It's on hold. It's grayed out. Oh, there we go. Okay, hang on just a second. There's Victoria. Hey, Victoria.
Hey, Tom.
So what's going on in the world today?
The Department of Justice will file an emergency stay request with the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals in advance of an appeal in the Immigration Executive Order case. That is the case in which a Texas judge on Monday said that President Obama and the Department of Homeland Security did not have the authority to grant stays of deportation and work permits for up to about 4 million undocumented immigrants, which would have started on Wednesday.
Right.
So they're filing an emergency stay request. That's per the White House. That's just come in. Don't have any more details on that. That's
okay.
Just happened.
Cool.
Also, President Obama today addressed the Democratic National Committee winter meeting in Washington, D.C., and he was fired up and ready to go.
Did he say anything of consequence?
He got a raucous response from the crowd. Yeah, he criticized Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell's recent suggestion that positive economic signs could be connected to the GOP sweeping victory in the 2014 midterm election. He said that our Republican leader in the Senate, as he was coming in after trying to block every single thing that we've done to strengthen the economy, starts looking at jobs numbers, says, you know, it's getting better because we just got elected and people are feeling more optimistic, which, okay, I didn't know that's how the economy worked, but maybe we'll call some economists.
There you go. Hey, I have a question for you.
Yes.
Rudy Giuliani said that the president doesn't love America and doesn't love us, and that the reason why is the values with which he was raised.
Yes.
And looking at this biography of Rudy Giuliani, the book is titled Rudy, an investigative biography of Rudy Giuliani by Village Voice reporter Wayne Barrett. Wayne Barrett points out that Harold Giuliani, Rudy's dad, well, first of all, Obama, the man who raised Obama, was his grandfather. He was the male figure in the house, and Obama lived with his grandparents without his mother for some time, you know, I guess about a year, I think, while she was still in Indonesia. His grandfather, Obama's grandfather, not only fought in World War II, but was there at the invasion of Normandy. I mean, it doesn't get more red, white, and blue than that.
Yes.
Giuliani's father, a fellow by the name of Harold Giuliani, served a year and a half in Sing Sing prison after robbing a milkman at gunpoint in 1934, and then, according to this biography, served as muscle for a loan sharking outfit, claiming that, and now quoting Harold Giuliani, "I broke legs, smashed kneecaps, and crunched noses in the 1950s and took part in a gunfight in a Brooklyn street in the 1960s. Do most people know this about Rudy Giuliani, that his dad was,
no.
was a mob enforcer and served a year and a half in prison? And might that inform his, you know, what does that say about Giuliani saying, "I was raised with different values than Barack Obama"?
I don't think most people know that.
Huh. Interesting. Well, something you can share if you'd like.
Very interesting.
It's over at crooksandliars.com. Back to you.
Yes, the Obama administration, under heavy pressure from congressional Democrats, announced today that it would give several million people more time to buy health insurance so they could comply with federal law and avoid tax penalties. They'll basically get a period from March the 15th to April the 30th, which will take them through tax filing system season. Now, it's only a one-time deal, but it's so that they can avoid penalties if they think that they might be subject to them. Also, so that was the good news today on Obamacare. The not-so-good news was that about 800,000 taxpayers who enrolled in insurance policies through healthcare.gov received erroneous tax information from the government. They were urged today to hold off on filing tax returns until the error could be corrected, which won't be until early March, because this incorrect insurance information is used in computing taxes.
Right.
So Republicans have jumped on that.
Of course. Of course. Oh, my God. Something went wrong.
Yeah, they're saying that the law is so convoluted that it's unworkable.
Yeah.
Virginia Senator Mark Warner, Democrat, wants American workers to get their billions back this filing season, not thieves. After the GAO released a report yesterday revealing that the IRS issued appropriately $5.8 billion in fraudulent refunds in 2013.
Whoa.
Yes, that much. Warner sent a letter to IRS Commissioner John Koskinen questioning whether the IRS could detect fraud by checking taxpayer refunds against W-2 data.
Mm-hmm. I assumed that that's what they did.
No.
Really?
No, they don't, because of privacy issues.
Well, wait a minute. The W-2 is what you file with the IRS. I mean, I have gotten letters back from the IRS over the years where I forgot to list, you know, I had some 1099 income and I didn't report it to the IRS, but whoever paid me that did report it to the IRS. And so when I filed my taxes, they get kicked back to me saying, "Hey, wait a minute, you know, you didn't tell us about some income you had." I mean, it's been more than a decade.
He said the IRS often uncovers an incident of identity theft before the victim does, when a data thief files a fraudulent tax return using a stolen SSN.
Oh,
unfortunately,
yeah.
The agency has interpreted privacy laws as prohibiting the IRS from warning taxpayers that their SSN may have been stolen.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
Yes.
Oh, well, that's not good.
Not good.
Yeah.
So Warner had a bill last year that would change that, but it didn't make it out of committee, along with Senator Ron Johnson, Republican of Wisconsin. Huh. So might be an idea to reintroduce that law.
Yeah, might be.
Might be. And from the Canadian file, a Canadian MP offered one of the most original excuses ever heard for leaving Parliament in a hurry. He bought cut-price underpants. They were too tight. He could not sit through the vote.
Hey, I saw the clip of that. That's hysterical. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com. Check it out. Ellen's in South Sudan right now. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you.
Great talking with you. We'll be back with Anything Goes Friday after this.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And according to the Huffington Post, actually it's according to Reuters, Dateline Brussels, Eurozone finance ministers drafted an outline agreement on Friday that could form the basis for extending Greece's financial rescue package, officials on both sides said. However, they stressed there was no formal deal on the common text in the full 19-nation Eurogroup ministers. Looks like there's not a lot of detail here. But, you know, we'll see where this goes. Anyhow, interesting times we live in. Bob in Clifton, Tennessee. Hey, Bob, what's on your mind today?
Hello, Tom. Well, you've had an embattled day, but you've handled it with grace.
Thank you.
I don't mean to pile on, but...
Feel free.
Since the last time we spoke, something's been on my mind. We both agreed that the TPP, the SHAFTA trade agreements, are a threat to our sovereignty.
Yes.
And you said, when I suggested that some Congress people tell us what they have learned about it, that it would be mess up their day if they got arrested and they couldn't get anything else done.
You're right.
So my rub is, liberals cheer when common people get arrested for protesting important but somewhat lesser threats, such as civil rights and anti-war, and more recently Occupy Wall Street, police brutality, Keystone XM pipeline, and the climate change protests at the White House.
Sure.
But they have no spine to challenge the prohibition to even tell the American people what they have learned is in SHAFTA.
I think it would be a marvelous thing if a member of Congress was to go read one of the sections and then come out and hold a press conference and tell people what it says in violation of the rules or the law or whatever. But, Bob, my guess as to why nobody has done this, and I've not had this conversation with any Democratic members of Congress, so this is just my guess. But my guess is that because SHAFTA, the TPP, is being promoted by the head of their party, the President of the United States, the head Democrat, to do what you and I would love to see happen, would so alienate them from their own caucus, from their own peers, that they would probably find it very difficult to get any consequential legislation done, anything done on behalf of their district. They would shoot themselves in the foot in terms of their own effectiveness in Congress, and you know, therefore they're afraid to do it. Now, I'm not saying, I'm not defending them.
It's not right for me to go to jail protesting civil rights.
Correct.
And mess up my life and then not be able to reinstate myself in the post office because of it.
Right.
And, you know, I'm not suggesting a press conference. If they got up on the floor of Congress and spoke, they would have congressional immunity to protect themselves.
You're right.
And they should take the chance of alienating. If this is truly a threat to the sovereignty of the United States, which I believe it is, then they should do the right thing, even if it is that they can't get another post office named in their district.
Yeah. Bob, I absolutely agree with you. And, you know, we'll see. I mean, as this thing shakes out, maybe somebody will stand up and do something like that. It has not yet reached that critical point. A lot of us thought it was going to happen over the Christmas break. It didn't. And I think it's entirely possible that the president's going to walk away from this, although who knows. Bob, thank you for the call. Jim, be sure to put that up on YouTube, that call. There's a couple of members of Congress I'd like to forward it to. Don't put that part of it in there. Denise in Calumet, Michigan. Hey, Denise, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Can you hear me?
I hear you just fine. Is it hard for you to hear me?
No, I can hear you just
okay.
fine.
Okay, great. What's up?
Your book, The Crash of 2016, is just awesome. I want you to know that my husband read it. I'm reading it. We were giving it to my dad. He's giving it to his friends.
Wow. Thank you.
It's just incredible. There's so many things I wanted to talk to you about, especially listening to Bernie Sanders and the Senate the other day. But yesterday you guys were talking about a little bit about marijuana.
Right.
And since it's Anything Goes Friday, I don't know if a lot of people are aware of this, but there is a syndrome called cyclic vomiting syndrome.
Hmm.
And they're finding out in Colorado and a lot of the states that have, you know, legalized marijuana that it's the edibles. People are eating too much of the edibles and they're coming to the emergency rooms with this thing called cyclic vomiting syndrome. It's something that usually happens in children and they can't figure out why, but now it's happening to adults. And too many adults are too afraid to say, well, guess what? I did increase my use of marijuana in the form of edibles, and the liver can't keep up with the amount of edibles some of these people are eating. They can actually go into shock, and they can actually die from this. And I think that people need to be aware of that, that the edibles, they just can't eat as much as they think they can. And I think that there needs to be research done so that it doesn't kill the whole thing that, you know, medical marijuana can be good for you.
Right. Denise, if anybody had ever died of marijuana via cyclic vomiting syndrome or any other mechanism, it would be, you know, all the anti-drug people would, they'd have it on billboards.
Oh, I know.
So I doubt anybody's ever died of it, but, you know, we had somebody call up a couple of days ago who said, and this might be what you're reacting to, one guy called and said that he had smoked some oil or some tar or something like that, and then he vomited a lot. And then another guy called up, and he said that's because they make the oil, they make the tar with solvents, and some of those solvents get left behind if it's badly made or if it's amateurly made, and you're being poisoned by the solvents, not by the pot.
Right.
So that's a possibility. I don't know if you saw the article last week, but there was this guy over at, he wrote for the Daily Beast, and he took 90 times the full dose that you would normally take of pot to get high. And typically you would smoke, you know, or eat, you know, 2, 3, 5, at the most 10 milligrams of THC, of tetrahydrocannabinol, the active ingredient. And you can buy chocolates in Colorado that are 10 milligram chocolates, that are like one dose chocolates. He bought 90 of those, ate them all at once. And he said that the biggest problem he had for the first hour was that he was hating the taste of chocolate by that time. He had just eaten so much of it. But here he is with 900 milligrams of THC in him. If one shot of alcohol is enough to get a person moderately high, this would be like 900 shots of whiskey, right? Which you and I both know would kill anybody. And he thought he was going to have some amazing trip, and he was going to write a story about it that would win him the Pulitzer Prize, some new version of Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, Hunter S. Thompson's iconic novel. And instead what happened was he got really high for about a half hour, and then he fell asleep for 17 hours. So that's typically what happens with a marijuana overdose, is people fall asleep. You know, Maureen Dowd notwithstanding.
That is typical. I have seen four different people, you know, with the cyclic vomiting syndrome now.
Really?
Yes. And the only other thing that I can connect that to is that there was something else wrong with the person at the time. They either had a bronchitis, a pneumonia.
Was all of this in Michigan, Denise?
Yeah.
So it could have also been that they were getting contaminated pot.
Yeah, but they were getting them from different places. Actually, one of them was in Florida.
Yeah, Because, a fair amount of the pot that's sold in the United States is contaminated with pesticides, with herbicides, with heavy metals, and sometimes they contaminate it with actual drugs that make you more high but, are not good for you. It's a strong argument for legalization and regulation. But that's very interesting. I'm going to have to look into it. Denise, thank you for the heads up on that. Thank you for the call. We'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Okay, best tweet of the day. This is from LOL GOP. There are now one same-sex married couples in Texas for every 6.4 million uninsured Texans. Guess which problem the Republicans are trying to solve? Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Keith, watching Free Speech TV in Landrum, South Carolina. What's on your mind, Keith?
Hey, Tom. I hope everything's going well for you.
So far, so good. What's up?
Yeah, okay. Electric blankets are your friend for cold weather.
Yes. Actually, Louise got me an electric blanket for, I think it was Valentine's Day. Maybe it was Christmas. And we leave it on the couch. I when I get home at night, we watch the evening news, and I pull the thing over me. It's I don't like sleeping with them because I don't like all the EMF
that's also a problem, but yeah. Anyway. Yeah. Last week when I was talking on the talk with Bernie, you and Bernie kind of blew me off when I was asking about Title II regulations and you assumed I was talking about sales tax. I was not talking about sales tax on the internet. I was talking about Title II regulations.
Okay. Set me straight here, Keith.
Yeah. The Senate and the House are trying to pass internet tax, which is access taxes for the internet, and prohibiting states and local communities from charging access taxes for internet fees on the internet. And so they're trying to pass this legislation. Now we have the Title II net neutrality laws going through the FCC, and the fear from the right now is, oh, my God, the FCC is going to be charging access taxes on the Internet. If they're going through the Internet Tax Freedom Act, as is being proposed in Congress, why can't they block FCC from denying access taxes on that as well?
Well, Congress always has the ability to do that. They, the FCC is just an agency. They promulgate rules, they make rules, but they don't make laws. And
I agree completely, but as you have had in your previous talking points about how Congress has the ability to legislate, why can't they block that? They can do that. They can block the president from executive orders. They can block the Supreme Court from doing the, legislating for the bench, anything else they can do. Why can't they do this too? No, they would rather have talking points of saying, we need to support big corporations and block net neutrality.
Right. Yeah, they could do that, Keith. Congress could pass a law saying, here's the new rules for the FCC. This is how you have to behave.
Well, please pass that along to Bernie next time you talk.
Okay, will do. Thank you very much, Keith. Good to hear from you. Thanks for the heads up. Cliff in Canyon Country, California. Got a minute to the break, Cliff. It's all yours.
Oh, minute. I don't know. Well, I wanted to really quickly add something to your discussion with Kamara about 9/11. Mm-hmm. You two were talking about the Twin Towers, but your opinions or facts about the melting of steel doesn't apply to Building 7.
Sure it does.
It's a 47-story building that pancaked to the ground in 6.5 seconds.
Right, because it had 24,000 gallons of fuel oil on its on the top floor for the emergency generators. And when that fuel oil was hit by burning airplane debris, it caught on fire.
You can go watch the video online about Building 7. I mean, it looks like the classic controlled demolition.
Yeah.
Anyways, Tom, I read a story written by Alan Grayson on Truthout. It's about the Defense Authorization Act. John McCain and Jeff Flake, they inserted this land swap deal that takes 4 square miles of the Tonto National Forest in Arizona.
Right, from the Indians.
Two of the biggest mining companies in the world. So
right.
They can build a copper mine.
That's right. They gave it to Rio Tinto. It is wrong. We have talked about this on the air. This was, you know, John McCain's sellout of the Native Americans. It's the Apache Tears territory. Cliff, thank you for the call. I don't know if this was in the welcome back, by the way. I don't know if this was in the New York City edition or in the national edition of the New York Times, but there is an ad in today's New York Times, a large ad, and at the top it says name, Speaker John Boehner, date March 3rd, 2015, and then it's a three questions with multiple choice. And the three questions are, number one, who is our commander-in-chief? And there's a picture of Obama and a picture of Netanyahu. And then the second question is, pick one, A or B. A is a quote from Obama, B is a quote from Netanyahu, both in 2002. Right? This is before the invasion of Iraq. Obama said, this will only fan the flames of the Middle East. That's what Obama said. Here's what Netanyahu said in 2002 about the U.S. invading Iraq. I guarantee you that it will have enormous positive reverberations on the region. So pick one. Which one was right about the Iraq war? And finally, what is number three? What is the best way to prevent a nuclear-armed Iran? A diplomatic agreement. B, another war. And then the text says, will Congress side with our president or with a foreign leader? President Obama is on the verge of a diplomatic victory that will prevent war and prevent a nuclear-armed Iran. But congressional hawks are bringing Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu to Capitol Hill to push for new sanctions that could kill the talks and start a war. Call Congress to support diplomacy, not war. 1-844-ACT-NIAC. Now, the NIACouncil.org/no-Iran-war is who put this ad up, and I don't know who that is. I'm going to have to dig into that, but it's fascinating. Oh, it's the National Iranian American Council. Oh, perfect, perfect. And then DHS. Did you know that in 2009, when the Department of Homeland Security issued their warning about right-wing terrorism in the United States, that there was so much blowback. Remember all that blowback? All the right-wingers hysterical and bloviating and Fox News and right-wing hate radio, and everybody was going nuts about it. The Obama administration pulled the report and stopped and had the FBI stop tracking right-wing terrorism. Well, it's gotten so bad that they're back to it. DHS intelligence report warns of domestic right-wing terror attacks. New intelligence assessment circulated by the DHS this month and reviewed by CNN focuses on the domestic terror threat from right-wing sovereign citizen extremists. What they're saying, the Homeland Security report produced in coordination with the FBI counts 24 violent sovereign citizen-related attacks across the U.S. since 2010. 24 terrorist attacks in the United States by right-wingers. Talk about incidents such as the one in 2012 in which a father and son were accused of engaging in a shootout with police in Louisiana, a confrontation that began when an officer pulled him over for a traffic violation. Two officers were killed, several others wounded. The men were sovereign citizen extremists who claimed police had no authority over them. This is astonishing. They've got a map of the United States showing all the places where these terrorist acts by sovereign citizens have happened. The Department of Justice, you know, yeah, we're trying to do something about this. survey was part of a study produced by the University of Maryland's National Consortium on the Study of Terrorism and Responses to Terrorism. Mark Potok at the Southern Poverty Law Center says there are between 100,000 and 300,000 of these potential right-wing terrorists, people involved with this movement. He says sovereign citizen groups have attracted support because of poor economic conditions, which is what Obama was saying yesterday is one of the things that's leading to right-wing extremism in the Middle East, to ISIS and Boko Haram and these other right-wing groups. And then they say, in 2009, a Homeland Security report on possible recruitment of military veterans by right-wing militia groups prompted an outcry from veterans groups. And Napolitano criticized her own agency for the report. Brilliant. It was a report that was actually put together during the Bush administration. But it came out during the Obama administration, so Obama and Napolitano got all the flack for it. Incredible. Donna in Albuquerque, New Mexico. It's Anything Goes Friday. You want to talk about contrails?
Yes, Tom. I first wanted to say thank you very much for your TV show. I think it's the best out there.
Thank you.
You bet. The first thing, the elephant in the room, I think, that needs to be addressed is this weather modification, SRM, and aka chemtrails. Now, I truly believe that the government is modifying the albedo or the reflectivity of our Earth. And even the National Academy of Science just put out a paper. Now, they're saying that this should absolutely not be done. And I believe if people get out on a hilltop with a 360 view and observe the sky for quite a period of time and use critical thinking and observation skills, they will come to the conclusion that our Earth's atmosphere is being tinkered with.
Well, you don't have to even do that, Donna. Just look at the difference in solar radiation during the 3 days when there were no planes flying after 9/11. There were no vapor trails at that time. You're right that when jet engines burn diesel fuel or burn kerosene, they break down the hydrocarbons and produce water vapor. You know, water vapor and carbon dioxide are what come out the exhaust of a jet engine. And that water vapor at 30,000 feet, where it's 60 degrees below zero, instantly freezes and creates what look like cirrus clouds, which are long, you know, trails of ice crystals that can take a day or two to melt and or be a, you know, evaporate back into the atmosphere. And they do reflect sunlight. They are reducing the reflectivity or increasing the reflectivity of our atmosphere. But they're not putting titanium dioxide. They're not putting whitening agents into jet planes now. That has been suggested.
Aluminum or barium that's going in the
There would be a small amount of aluminum just because the engines are made out of aluminum. It's just being ground off, Donna. But that's, you know, I guarantee you, United Airlines, American Airlines, they're not sitting around going, hey, let's conspire with the government to mess with the atmosphere and maybe put our passengers at risk by putting weird stuff in our jet fuel. Thank you, Donna, for the call. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
Just because it's on the Internet doesn't mean it's true. I don't know how to say it other than that. We'll be back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And I just came across this amazing piece. Actually, I printed it and then I neglected to go get it out of the printer. I'll just bring it up here and read it from the about Rudy Giuliani. Here it is. This is from the New York Daily News, and it's by Wayne Barrett. He's the guy that I was, you know, he wrote the book about the biography of Rudy Giuliani, and he talks about how Rudy Giuliani knows a lot about love. You know, keep in mind, Giuliani said the president of the United States, Barack Obama, does not love America, doesn't love you, doesn't love me, doesn't love America. So, anyhow, Wayne Barrett says, just ask Regina Peruggi, the second cousin that Rudy Giuliani grew up with and then married, who was offended when Rudy later engineered an annulment from the priest who was his best man on the grounds, strangely enough, that she was his cousin. Right? Therefore, annul the wedding. Or ask Donna Hanover, the mother of his two children, who found out he wanted a separation when he left Gracie Mansion one morning and announced it at a televised press conference. Or ask Judy Nathan, his third wife, whom he started dating while still married to Hanover and was the mayor of New York. In two SUVs, he and an entourage of six or seven cops traveled 11 times to Judy's Hamptons getaway at a taxpayer cost of $3,000 a trip. That is love, says Wayne Barrett. It's amazing. Rudy knows so much about love that he declared the president doesn't love you. Right. He goes on to say, Rudy may have forgotten the half dozen deferments he won ducking the Vietnam War, even getting a federal judge he was clerking for to write a letter creating a special exemption just for him. And remember Bernie Carrick? He's the Giuliani police commissioner, business partner, and sidekick, whose nomination as Homeland Security Secretary narrowly preceded his indictments. He's doing his national service in prison, Carrick. And then he gets into, you know, Rudy's dad, who didn't serve in World War II because he was a convicted felon, and his uncles, who were mobsters, none of them served in World War II either, whereas Obama's grandfather and uncle, his uncle helped liberate Buchenwald, and his grandfather was there for Normandy. It's really quite amazing. Rudy was a consultant for the government of Qatar, the country his friend and FBI director Louis Free accused of hiding 9/11 mastermind Khalid Sheikh Mohammed before the attack. It's amazing. It's amazing. There's a whole lot more there. I encourage you to check it out. It's New York Daily News, and it's also over at Huffington Post right now. Anything goes Friday. James, you wanted to talk about, do I have this right, vaccines and aspartame?
Yeah, Tom, first of all, let me say, if we're having a problem of these guys being too big to jail, we need to build a bigger jail, don't we?
Yeah, I think we've got plenty of jails. We need to let the people out who shouldn't be there, and we need to put the people in who should be there.
And maybe enlarge them a little bit if we have to.
Yeah.
I agree. With the vaccines, I think I've read reports that there's also trace elements of aluminum and formaldehyde in them.
Could be. I am not an expert on vaccines, so I can't speak to that.
Okay, about the aspartame, It's in all our gum now. I think you made mention of the fact it converts to formaldehyde or formic acid.
Yeah, formaldehyde in the presence of heat is my understanding. Again, I'm not an expert on aspartame.
Yeah, again, what I heard about that, and I might be wrong too, it converts at like 80 degrees Fahrenheit.
Yeah, it doesn't take a lot because there was a bunch of, the way I learned about it, and again, I'm assuming this was true, it might be an internet story and I might have it wrong, but my understanding is that during the first Gulf War, that the George Herbert Walker Bush administration had a bunch of soft drinks shipped over to the troops at the Air Force Base in Saudi Arabia, the Prince Bandar Air Force Base or whatever it's called. And a bunch of that was diet soda and that was sweetened with aspartame and the heat there. I mean, you know, it's 100 degrees on an average day and you put it in the sun, it gets 120, 130, caused that diet, all those diet drinks, or many of those diet drinks, to become poisonous because the aspartame was converting to formaldehyde in the cans. Now, whether that's true or not, I can't definitely assert. I don't have that from a firsthand source. I just read it maybe 30 or 40 times in different places back, you know, a decade ago.
If you check into how the FDA approved it, it was a totally corrupt process.
Oh, and Donald Rumsfeld was involved with it. He was the president of Searle at the time, which had developed aspartame, and they were having real serious problems with the FDA's, you know, demonstrating safety to the FDA. And then Rumsfeld, you know, started lobbying personally on behalf. There's a whole sordid story around it that involves Don Rumsfeld. Again, if my recollection is correct, these are topics I haven't talked about in a decade, I think. But yeah. James, thanks for the call. Interesting stuff. John in Gatlinburg, Tennessee. Hey, John, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Real quick on what you were just discussing, aspartame is also an ingredient in embalming fluid.
No, that's formaldehyde is in embalming fluid. That's what aspartame breaks down to.
Well, okay, yes. Basically the same thing, right?
No, aspartame is a much more complex molecule that, when it breaks down, breaks into formaldehyde and a bunch of other things. Apparently.
Okay, well, what I called you about is on your green energy and your carbon tax.
Yeah.
In July of last year, Australia had carbon tax on their business for 2 years.
Right.
And they shut it down because of the high cost of the citizens.
No, that's not true,
America,
John.
America don't need another tax.
John, that's not true. They shut it down because the new president and the new parliament was elected with billions or millions of dollars from the richest woman in Australia, whose name has escaped me for a long time. The one who said that, you know, basically she talked about little people and talked, you know, down about poor people and all this stuff. She's a mining baroness. And the fossil fuel industry has basically taken over the Australian government the same way they took over the United States government, arguably 70, 80 years ago. Gina Reinhart, yeah, that was her name. And it's not just her. I mean, it's a whole bunch of these fossil fuel barons. And
One other thing, what you were talking about a while ago about the health care, the last thing this country needs is social insurance.
Yeah.
Like universal health care, or single payer health care.
Yeah, it's better for people to just die, right, John?
No, let me ask you something. Do you believe in personal responsibility?
Let me ask you something, John. If you get cancer, is it your fault?
No.
Okay, then you don't believe in personal responsibility.
Yeah, I do, but I mean, it's not my cancer. Which I believe. I was raised with medical family members, and I understand, and I believe that there's a cure for cancer that. Pharmaceutical companies won't allow it because it would do like it did with polio. They found a treatment or a cure for it. It took out the treatment and they lost money. I look at the same thing with cancer. I mean, we've spent billions of dollars over the years for finding a treatment or a cure, but we've never found one.
Yeah, I think that's because cancer isn't just one thing, John. There's all different kinds of cancers. But I'm astonished that you would say that somehow a person who's earning, say, somebody's working full-time, they got a couple of kids, they're working full-time at Walmart and McDonald's, they're making $15,000 a year, and you want them, through their personal responsibility, to spend $6,000 or $7,000 a year for health insurance. I don't get it. That sounds brutal to me. It sounds inhuman to me. Why would you do that?
Well, the reason you took my you didn't let me finish on the personal responsibility. America gives people like on disability and Social Security a quarter of what they should be getting. What is it they spend every year on welfare social programs in this country?
It's very little.
$900 million or $900 billion.
It's got to be. I don't know the number, but I do know that it amounts to less than $15 for every taxpayer in America. The money that we spend on welfare programs in the country. It's inconsequential compared to the amount of money that we spent in 2 weeks in Iraq.
Million. But if you paid that, if you shut down welfare, you shut down food stamps, you give that money directly to the people and let them buy their own insurance, let them provide their own way of living, we wouldn't have people in offices getting part of your money that you should be getting.
So you want the federal government to go into the business of passing out money to people. Are you talking about a guaranteed minimum income like they have up in Alaska where every man, woman, and child gets a couple $1,000 every year?
Canada tried it a few years ago and for some reason stopped it.
Well, Alaska's doing it right now.
Well, I mean, if you do that, then people in the offices don't get the money that the citizens should be getting.
Yeah.
You know, and
John, if your goal is to get rid of government bureaucracies and to get rid of welfare programs by giving every citizen enough cash that they can live, whether they work or not, whether they're disabled or not, if you're talking about the guaranteed basic income, guaranteed minimum income that Switzerland is going to be voting on next year, I'm with you. I think that that's a much more efficient way to do it. Similarly, people complain about the high levels of food stamps. If you simply raise the minimum wage to $11 or $12 an hour, all those people who qualify for food stamps right now because they're working at Walmart or McDonald's and they're making so little would no longer qualify for food stamps. And they wouldn't need
That's
to
right.
because they'd have a decent income. So there are
That's
ways,
right.
but typically you suggest that, if I suggest that to a conservative, and it sounds like you are, John, their rebuttal to me is, wait a minute, government shouldn't be setting prices in the marketplace for labor.
Well, it's just like with green energy, the marketplace should control allow green energy to come along when it's feasible. And
John, I couldn't disagree with you more strongly. What you're saying would be true if fossil fuels were not poisonous to us, if they weren't poisonous to our environment, if they weren't destroying our planet, and if they weren't responsible for wars all over the, you know, all over this planet. You know, nobody has ever, to the best of my knowledge, fought a war over solar panels. John, thanks for trying. You know, good effort.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
I mean, there are times when it's really appropriate to take the Constitution seriously and do what is in the best of the general welfare of the public. Welcome back. 15 minutes before the hour. And Jim, watching Free Speech TV in Lockport, Illinois. Hey, Jim, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how you doing?
Great. What's on your mind?
Always good to talk to you, man.
Thank you.
Matter of fact, I miss my friend Bernie, but your last caller, a little surprised about that. If the minimum wage, the last time they raised it, if it went to our cost of living, it would probably be over $11 an hour right now.
It would
now.
Be $12.27 an hour right now if it was where it was in 1968.
Yeah, that's true. One of the things I wanted to, actually there's two things. One thing about politicians, when they go out there and they, and Bernie's gonna run, one of the things I always hear them is they ask you for your vote. But one of the things I never hear them asking about, Tom, is they ask you to give you the tools. Give me the tools to do the job. And I think that's an important part of being elected. You need the tool to do the job.
Mm-hmm.
And, I really expect a wave in 2016. On the Democratic side, I really anticipate that.
Yeah, interesting.
Yeah,
interesting.
And another thing too was the Republican Party, and I mentioned you a while back. You probably remember saying that their logo, the elephant, may turn into the woolly mammoth. But an elephant's supposed to have a great memory. How come they keep forgetting about the Iraq War and how it brought ISIS into this situation?
Because it's inconvenient for them, for people to remember the Iraq War and to remember George Bush's role in it. And, you know, it's down the memory hole. You will never hear a mention of that on Fox News or right wing hate radio. You'll rarely hear a mention of it on the rest of the corporate media in America. And I think to some extent that's because the whole media machine in the United States, with a few exceptions, Michael Moore and Bill Maher, but you know, outside of them, the entire media machine in the United States was aggressively pushing for the Iraq War, or at least being, quote, neutral. And the questioning voices were marginalized or even fired. Phil Donahue got fired at GE, at MSNBC, for questioning the Iraq War. And so, you know, there's just like all this complicity, and nobody wants to own up to it. Jim, thanks for the call. It's good to hear from you. And Michelle in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Hey, Michelle, thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's up?
Hi, Tom. Hoping to finish out the week on a positive note and bring something to your attention. I was watching an old movie the other night called Monsieur Verdu, I think.
Okay.
1947, a Charlie Chaplin movie. Orson Welles was a contributor. Anyhow, one of the lines the Chaplin character says in the movie is, "Despair is a narcotic. It lulls the mind into indifference." And I immediately thought of you.
Oh, with my despair is not an option here thing?
Exactly. And is yeah. that the kind of thing that you're getting to, that despair, it lulls the mind into a sense of indifference?
Oh, absolutely. Despair is what the right wants us to feel. When the Koch brothers say we're going to spend $1 billion roughly on, you know, buying the next election, they want everybody on the other side to go, oh, my God, I you know, there's no way we can take that on. We're screwed. I guess I'll just give up. I'll stay home and suck my thumb. That's what they want. That's the response they want. And we can't give them that response. We can't go into despair. Despair is paralyzing. Despair is a narcotic, as you say, Michelle. And the best antidote to despair is action. Get out and do something. You may not see the results of your actions immediately. You may not even see it in your lifetime. But good action does produce results. Michelle, thank you for the call. Excellent, excellent call. Thank you. We'll be back. Hey, thanks so much to our show director, Louise Hartman, to our executive producer, Sean Taylor, to our associate producers, Shane Farnan and Danielle Gilday, to our video director, Jim Javinsky, to our writer-researchers, Andrew Campbell and Nate Sweet, to Alva Goldbook for video production, to our webmasters, Nigel Peacock and Jamie Holly, our business manager, Ron Hartenbaum, all the folks who syndicate our program, Westwood One, Pacifica Radio, Sirius XM Satellite Radio, Cable Radio Network, Free Speech TV, Dish Network, DirecTV, Comcast, Manhattan Neighborhood Network, all the great folks at Free Speech TV and RTTV who work on the big picture, to the Progressive Voices channel on TuneIn, to Netroots Radio, to our newsletter editor, Sue Nethercutt, all the folks in our chat room, to Ellen Ratner, Victoria Jones, Bob Ney, and everyone at the Talk Radio News Service, to Jay Goodman-Tamboli for tech support, to our affiliates, our sponsors, and to you for supporting our program. Thank you. And what's Lori's last name? I don't. My apologies, Lori. And special thanks to Lori, who's filling in for Danielle today and answering our phone. And I will recognize you appropriately as soon as somebody passes your name to me. She's on the phone. Okay, no wonder. Harvey in Berkeley. Hey, Harvey, what's on your mind?
Hi, Tom. Well, I read an article in today's San Francisco Chronicle that's the perfect example of environmental stress. And as you know, the problem with us burning fossil fuels like coal, oil, natural gas, methane, is that they produce heat-trapping gases like carbon dioxide that turn infrared light into heat. And this year, last year was the hottest year on record. And this put this destabilization of our atmosphere puts all life under stress, and stress equals death. And I have an example here, and this is the article. It says, warmer ocean tide to sea lion pups crisis. 940 of the mammals have washed up so far. It says the problem is that the ocean is 2 to 5 degrees warmer on average in this time of year, and the warmer ocean temperatures go down about 100 meters, enough to force fish that sea lions feed on to migrate north, making it harder for moms to find food for their pups.
Right.
So, and the same thing is true with forests. You know, the invasive bugs are moving north and eating up forests as they go. But we have the technology. We have the technology to transition to a clean, renewable energy future and slow down the global warming. And the key here is that they don't use water, because coal, oil, natural gas, and nuclear use about almost as much as agriculture every day. So the key is use no water and produce clean, renewable energy if we want to see a future, because environmental stress equals death.
Amen. Amen. Well said, Harvey. Thank you. Kyle in Albany, New York. Hey, Kyle, what's up?
Hi there, Tom. I just wanted to add something on the Giuliani issue. And
yeah,
what I think it is, people are going around sort of saying, well, why would Giuliani do that? He's not running for president and so on. I think it's because that he belongs to a movement, so to speak, which is loosely titled the New Traditionalist Movement. You're probably familiar with it. Eric Hubeck came up with the white paper many years ago. And basically it is that they must be willing to appear obnoxious. They cannot consider themselves above appearing unseemly or surrendering to some sort of personal dignity.
I remember that from, like a decade ago, digging something out.
2001.
Yeah.
2001. Basically, and I know you're at the end of the show, so I just wanted to point out, and maybe people would think about this, that he's actually, it's a feature and not a bug. He's doing exactly what he's being paid to do. He's being obnoxious and obtuse. And then, you know, once this flap dies down, there'll be another guy out there that's going to be obnoxious and obtuse.
So you basically don't think that it's just because he's a racist punk. You think that he's actually running off a script that inures some financial benefit to him?
Well, I think he is a punk, but yeah, I agree with the second part, too.
Yeah. Fascinating. Kyle, thanks a lot for the call. That's amazing. That's just absolutely amazing. Thanks for the call. Great to hear from you. Barry in Chicago. Hey, Barry, what's up?
Okay, earlier in the week, I think it was this week, you talked about Judge Roy Moore in Alabama.
Yeah.
And you didn't seem to remember. He had a big statue of the Ten Commandments in front of the courthouse, or in the courthouse, and he was told to remove it, and he wouldn't remove it. So a panel of ethics panel of judges and lawyers kicked him out of office. Then he ran for the office again, and he won election again. So I'm assuming that he is going to face another ethics panel and get kicked off the Supreme Court of Alabama.
We'll see. Alabama's gotten a lot more Republican since then. They've really cemented control, and you know, it's been more than a decade, I think, since they had a Democratic senator or governor or anything. You know, so. So they're about Don Siegelman, I think, was the last Democrat who was the governor there. But you're right about Judge Moore. I wrote several op-eds about Judge Moore and how he was in complete contradiction to what Jefferson and the other founders believed, that there should be a wall of separation, to use James Madison's phrase, between government and religion. I'm with you. Thank you. Paul wants to, in Woodinville, Washington, you want to clean up something I said about aspartame. What did I get wrong, Paul?
Oh, it's not. This is a. I think this. We need to live with the work with the facts, and live with the truth on this one. Aspartame is nothing more than a dipeptide. It's the amino acids alanine and phenylalanine connected together in a peptide bond. It's just a piece of a protein,
right.
And it's the shape of the molecule which makes it taste sweet. So there really is no organic chemical mechanism for it to degrade to formaldehyde. Formaldehyde is the next oxidation step of methanol. And so that's why if you drink methanol, which is, as opposed to ethanol, which we can drink, your body process which oxidizes ethanol to acetaldehyde, which is what gives you a headache, would oxidize methanol to formaldehyde, and that would kill you. But there's no mechanism for this, so I think this is more to aspartame.
Yeah, I was repeating an urban legend then, basically.
Well, I think that's what it's made of, yeah.
Yeah, okay. Paul, thank you for that. I appreciate the correction. I would like this show to be as factual and accurate as possible, and you're one of the best. Thank you, Paul. Thank you, and thank you to all of you for being with us today, and hope you have a good weekend, and it's going to warm up a little bit. Maybe our boat will get unstuck. And we can go back to, actually moving around. Don't forget, democracy requires you. It's not a spectator sport. Tag, you're it. Get out there, get active. We'll see you on Monday. Have a great weekend.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, visit tomhartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.